Last Sunday, we suggested that the Latter-day Saints might be said to accept certain traditions common to the whole Christian world more wholeheartedly and with less reservation than most Christians do, inasmuch as they take as literal what the rest of the world accepts as in a rather vague, symbolic, mystical, or sentimental sense. Easter furnishes a good example, as any, of what we mean by this. There are two aspects of Easter, a formal and a literal, or one might say a ritual and a doctrinal. The formal aspect is that which everybody knows so well and to which we all subscribe. We all do certain things at Easter, whatever we may think. The uncritical acceptance of ancient customs has precious little to do with any particular doctrine. It's like the bands and fireworks at a political rally. They are not expression of the multitude's irrepressible enthusiasm for the party's principles. They are rather the means employed to create a popular enthusiasm with the hopes of transferring some of that emotion to the cause of the party. They create it. In the same spirit, the Christian church, long after the apostles, adopted the myriad Easter practices now found throughout the world. At the end of the 6th century, to cite a classic example, missionaries to Britain were impressed and disturbed by the great spring festival there of the heathens. They asked Gregory the Great what they should do about it, and in a famous letter he replied that they should let the people keep their darling festivities while turning the whole thing into a Christian celebration. Let them continue to slaughter their oxen and build their booths of green boughs, is Gregory's advice, only let it now be done, not for the devil, but in praise of God. For, he writes, it is absolutely certain that it is quite impossible to uproot everything at once from stubborn minds, since it's necessary for them to come along by degrees or steps, and not by leaps and bounds. Gregory's hope, here as he clearly states it, is that by making large concessions to the popular will, it might be possible to swing that will gradually over into the Christian orbit. Yet, bearing in mind that the old customs were being retained precisely because the people were too stubborn to give them up, there certainly was a great danger that the opposite would take place, and that the established customs of 1,000 years would prove of greater mass and charge than the new Christian teaching, which accordingly would be sucked into the older orbit, and not the other way around, and that's exactly what happened. Long before Gregory, Constantine the Great had followed the same policy in the East. He considered as one of his greatest triumphs the Christianizing of the great international festival in the plain of Marmara in Syria. He retained the festival, but he Christianized it thoroughly. Yet a pious Christian lady, Itheria or Sylvia, who visited the celebration a generation later, reports that while the wonderful rites are in full swing, they've lost all their Christian veneer and reverted to their original paganism. At the same time, almost in the same year, in the 380s AD, that this observation was made, John Chrysostom, the bishop of Antioch, complained that everybody came to church at Easter, and at Easter only, this is in the 4th century, notice, and in the largest and most important church in Christendom, simply says because it was the thing to do. For the rest of the year, he spoke, he declared, to empty walls. Even at this early date, the formal aspect of Easter had completely overcome the doctrinal. The only real justification for the Christian Easter is the proposition that the resurrection of Christ actually took place, not as a symbol, a myth, a hope, a tradition, or a dream, but as a real event. The Lord himself, after the resurrection, took the greatest care to impress the literalness of the event on the minds of all his followers. Having risen from the dead, Christ came to his disciples and found them confused, perplexed, incredulous. He upbraided them with their unbelief and hardness of heart because they believed not them which had seen him after he was risen. And he showed them in detail how the ancient prophets had actually predicted what had happened. He ordered them to feel him and see for themselves that he was not a spirit, that the flesh had been resurrected. He ordered food to be brought and in their presence invited them to dine with him, as the expression is. He told them that whenever they met after his departure, they should continue to eat real bread and drink real wine to remind them that he had been with them in the flesh. And there was need to make this lesson perfectly clear, for men have always been very reluctant to believe it. The apostles had to rebuke members of the church who simply wouldn't believe in the resurrection. John says, many deceivers are entered into the world who confess not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh. And remember Paul to the Corinthians, how say some among you that there is no resurrection of the dead? if Christ be not risen. Next, the writings of the so-called apostolic fathers, the oldest text to survive after the time of the apostles, show the spreading and deepening of this anti-resurrection trend in the church. Two charges are constantly brought against church members by the apostolic fathers. The first is that they are ashamed of the crucifixion. The second, they deny the resurrection. "I know that Christ had a body after the resurrection," cried Ignatius to the Smyrnaeans, perhaps the last man to bear his testimony in ancient times. "And I believe that he still has a body." We may note here in passing that there is no thought here of a mystic body. "I know he had one, and I believe he still has one." Ignatius pleads with the Trallians to believe that Christ, quote, "really and truly was born. He ate and drank, and he was really and actually sentenced under Pontius Pilate, and was actually crucified and died, and that he really and truly was raised from the dead. But if, as certain atheists, that is, non-believers, say he only appeared to have suffered, why am I going to fight beasts?" says Ignatius. In the longer version, Ignatius rebukes those who do not believe in the resurrection. Others say that God cannot be known. Others that think Christ was unbegotten. Others who claim that the Holy Ghost isn't a reality. Others who say that the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost are the same. The sorrows and alarms of these apostolic fathers were followed by the perplexity of the doctors. Those are the men that came later. Most of the early doctors of the church were ardent Hellenists or Neoplatonists, and there was no place in such schools of thought for a God who contaminated himself by contact with the physical or limited himself by taking on the form of a man. "We are stunned with the greatest amazement," wrote Origen, who is perhaps the most influential of them all, next to Augustine himself, "that this, the most eminent of all natures, putting off its state of majesty, should become a man. It is utterly beyond human comprehension that the word of the Father should be thought as confined in that man who appeared in Judea. But that the wisdom of God should have entered the womb of a woman and been born a baby and cried and wailed just like other crying babies and then suffered death and said that his soul was sorrowful unto death and been led off to the most undignified of all deaths, seeing such things the human intellect is stopped in its tracks, so stunned with amazement that it knows not where to turn. It is far beyond our powers to explain. I suppose," continues Origen, "it even goes beyond the capacity of the holy apostles. Nay, it is quite possible that the explanation of this sacrament is beyond the power of all celestial beings." Not only does Origen not know what to think about the Lord's physical presence on earth, he doesn't even know what to believe about it. And his explanation is, he's careful to specify here, that he presents only his suspicions rather than any manifest affirmations, as he puts it. So he speculates on the resurrection of the flesh. "Only the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost can live without bodies," he tells us, "because it is right and proper to think of the Trinity alone as existing incorporeally." But then he considers that if one can live without a body, others can too. And if others, why not all? "That being the case," he says, "bodies will be dispensed with in eternity, there being no need for them. To be subject to Christ is to be subject to God, and to be subject to God is to have no need of a body." Unquote. Commenting on this, St. Jerome writes a century and a half later, "If all things, as this order of reasoning compels us to believe, shall live without body, the whole universe of corporeal things shall be consumed and return again to that nothing out of which it was created." Note the vanity of the schoolman in Origen's remarks. What he cannot conceive of, because of his limited experience, must necessarily be beyond the grasp of apostles, angels, and all celestial beings. It is this sublime confidence in the adequacy of one's own knowledge and the finality of one's own experience that makes the resurrection of the flesh the principal thorn in the incorporeal minds of the schoolman. According to St. Augustine, "the resurrection of the flesh is the one thing that the pagans can't take," he says. He says it's the one thing with which the philosophers have no patience. And he says, above all, it is the one thing that distinguishes a Christian from a non-Christian. Since it is the one doctrine that makes Christians Christians, it is alarming to learn from St. Augustine that in his day, quote, "in nothing is there so much conflict and controversy among the Christians themselves as on the subject of resurrection of the flesh. On no other matter," he writes, "do they agree so vehemently, so obstinately, so resolutely, or so conscientiously as on the subject of resurrection of the flesh." As far as the immortality of the soul is concerned, many a pagan philosopher, too, has argued about it. This is still Augustine speaking. Has argued about that and bequeathed to us vast heaps of writings to the effect that the soul is immortal. But when it comes to the resurrection of the flesh, they won't even argue, but dismiss it out of hand as impossible, and that on the grounds that it is impossible for this earthly flesh to aspire to heaven. I can't resist noting here that the objection of the pagans to the resurrection is not a physical or a biological one. It's a philosophical one. And it happens to be the very same objections which the Christian world makes against the Latter-day Saint conception of God, that there can be nothing of a bodily nature in the celestial. Yet the resurrected Christ was God. Is it any wonder that the Christians could never agree among themselves on this, the central doctrine of their religion? The doctors of the later church only touch lightly on this theme and with obvious embarrassment. St. Augustine has far more to say on the subject than any other father of the church, yet he's very unsure of himself. He thinks, for example, that the body may become spirit in the sense of acquiring unlimited mobility, but he's not sure. He doesn't know exactly how to take the doctrine, which he says is extremely popular with the Christians of his own day, that the resurrection was a resurrection of the spirit, anima, only. And again, he says he would like to know how he's to think of a spiritual body, such as ours will be after the resurrection, but he doesn't know how, and he says he would be glad to find someone who could teach him. This was exactly the puzzled and hesitant attitude of Augustine's great Eastern counterpart, Origen, who lived earlier. It was those teachings that were not common to the schools and not discoverable by the use of reason that set Christianity apart from the rest of the world. Tertullian says if these things could have been discovered by human wit, there would have been no need for Christ to come in person. And on the other hand, if human philosophy can't discover them, then human philosophy has precious little to contribute to the study of the gospel. It was Karl Hull who noted that an unanswerable argument for the historicity of Christ is to be found in the strangeness of his teachings. What he taught was not at all familiar doctrine, but to use Hull's own expression, was a slap in the face to all the teachers of the time, Greek and Jew alike. The teaching that amazed and dumbfounded his own disciples could hardly have been familiar doctrine anywhere. From this emerged two obvious conclusions. The first is that Jesus actually lived, a man standing out in sharp relief against a totally hostile social environment. For without such a leader, no group of men could have come together, formed a society, and propounded a doctrine that ran counter to all their own teaching, upbringing, and experience, individual and collective. The second conclusion from this is that Jesus was not a product of his time. He is not to be explained in terms of his background. He cannot have got his ideas from a society to which they were utterly strange and obnoxious. He must have gotten his perfect conviction from personal experience. For the present, what can we do but accept his own version of the thing? He really had seen the Father. He really had seen Lucifer fall from heaven. He really did speak with Moses and Elias on the mount. He really did receive the ministrations of angels in the desert. And there he really did discourse with Satan. And he really was before Abraham's day and was really resurrected. There is nothing paradoxical about the resurrection. There is nothing paradoxical about a flying machine once one has seen one in operation. But seeing the thing operate only over and above all theoretical considerations of whether it should operate or not is what decides the matter. When falls of meteorites were reported in the 18th century, those are the stones that fall from heaven, the learned members of the French Academy argued with perfect and unanswerable logic that such a thing simply could not be. In the spirit of the Enlightenment, Thomas Jefferson is reported to have said regarding a meteorite that fell in Connecticut in 1807, "I could more easily believe that two Yankee professors would lie than that stones would fall from heaven." Logically, there was no answer to the natural philosophers. We still don't know where meteorites come from. But where the 18th century scientist fell down was exactly where Origen failed. He was convinced, remember, that what he could not reason out was beyond reason. They were convinced that what their science had not officially noted simply did not exist, and that what could not be scientifically explained by them was necessarily impossible. But even with the fullest scientific information at hand, such a conclusion is not warranted. Every scientist knows that the drawing board and the equation do not have the final word, no matter how accurate and exhaustive the work may be. Recently, Edwin H. Armstrong, one of the greatest American scientists, died. He specialized, we're told, in immensely practical and ingenious devices which theoretically could not possibly work. That made him the principal creator of modern radio. Well, once the fall of the meteorites was proved by witnesses in 1803, the Academy promptly shifted from complete denial to complete acceptance, and everybody acted as if they'd never questioned the thing for a minute. So it was with the resurrection. In a moment, Thomas changed from doubt to assurance so perfect that he was astonished and humiliated at ever having doubted anything so obvious. No matter how wildly improbable or paradoxical or utterly impossible a thing may seem to the cleverest people on earth, it is by witnesses alone and not by reason, theory, or speculation that its truth must be ultimately established, whether the truth be scientific or religious. This is the testimony which we give of him, that he lives. For we saw him, we heard the voice bearing record that he is the only begotten of the Father. Compare this testimony of modern prophets with that of the ancients. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon and our hands have handled of the word of life. That which we have seen and heard declare we unto you. After all, it is the testimony of the prophets that gives us the real Easter.